This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, all eyes are on Tampa this week as the party faithful of the GOP have gathered for their nominating convention.
That's right, Mark. Though Hurricane Isaac has caused a day's delay, the convention is still underway. At this point, really a formality, Mitt Romney is expected to be officially named the Republican candidate for president.
And Paul Ryan is the number two man on the ticket. I expect the campaign will get pretty intense from now until Election Day. And of course, the Democrats hold their primary next week.
And it will certainly be interesting to see how the messaging rolls out during the campaign on things like healthcare and Medicare, which were already hot topics. Certainly the GOP strongly rallying around the repeal Obamacare cry, and that's a theme at the Republican convention.
It does make one wonder what would happen to reform measures under a different leadership, Margaret. It's a very important election for all Americans who are passionate about health reform and access to healthcare for all.
And one organization that has been doing the hard work when it comes to reform is the Center for American Progress.
They're an independent nonpartisan educational institute aimed at improving the lives of Americans through progressive ideas in national security, economic growth, and in healthcare.
Topher Spiro is their managing director of health policy, and he's somebody who is very active in the development of the Affordable Care Act since his days on the Hill and has some very keen insights on some of the many powerful provisions in the law that are poised to improve access to healthcare in this country, and in particular, cost and savings seem to be his specialty area.
We're looking forward to hearing Topher's interview. FactCheck.org's Laurie Robertson takes a look at the latest campaign claims about health reform. Always good to get her perspective.
And no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by Googling CHC Radio.
And as always, if you have a comment, you can contact us at chcradio.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love to hear from you.
We'll get to Topher Spiro in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with this headline news. The campaign rhetoric is flying just as fast and furious as those hurricane winds. The Republican National Convention is underway. 70,000 GOP delegates gathered in Tampa this week to officially crown Mitt Romney as the 2012 Republican candidate for president. Paul Ryan selected as the number two man on the ticket. Much of the talk in Tampa is about repealing the president's health care law and rescuing Medicare for seniors. Much attention has been given to the Ryan budget plan passed in the House of Representatives that would turn Medicare into a voucher system that would require seniors receiving Medicare to purchase insurance with those vouchers. Both sides in the campaign are claiming the other side is going to gut Medicare for seniors. The Democrats hold their nominating convention next week. Meanwhile, during the president's weekly address, he did announce that under his health care law, 5.4 million seniors on Medicare have saved more than $4 billion on prescription drugs, and 18 million seniors have taken advantage of the free cancer screenings now being offered under the plan. The healthcare laws call for a more meaningful and rapid transition to electronic health records. And while the pace of change has picked up, still only about half of the nation's medical practices have made the switch. A new Harris poll out might shed some light on the general reluctance out there. 63% of those polled feared hackers might easily gain access to their health information or that it could be lost, damaged, or corrupted. That sentiment has remained relatively unchanged over the past 2 years. While many fear electronic health records are vulnerable, close to 70% of those polled felt modernizing electronic health records would make healthcare more efficient and save money. The nation's pharmacies, however, have made great strides in electronic prescription filing. Walgreens announced it was rolling out an electronic health record system built by Greenway Medical Systems. The EHR program, currently running in 200 facilities, will be rolled out to all of Walgreens' 8,000 locations. The saying goes, if you snooze, you lose. But in this case, not snoozing enough can really cost you. A study out shows seniors with poor sleep patterns and habits were more likely to develop dementia. That study showed frequent sleep interruptions from things like apnea are indicators for developing dementia down the line. I'm Marianne O'Hare with this headline news.
We're speaking today with Topher Spiro, Managing Director of Health Policy at the Center for American Progress, an independent, nonpartisan educational institute dedicated to improving the lives of Americans through progressive ideas and actions. Mr. Spiro is focused specifically on promoting the implementation of the Affordable Care Act and promoting cost containment in healthcare. He served as Deputy Staff Director for Health Policy for the U.S. Senate Committee on Health, Education, and Labor under Senators Ted Kennedy and Tom Harkin, and was on the team that drafted the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Topher, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You know, everyone's talking about the most obvious aspects of the Affordable Care Act, the big three, the inclusion of millions of uninsured Americans into health coverage, people with pre-existing conditions who can't be denied coverage, young adults up to age 26 being able to stay on their parents' policy. But what are we missing in the discussion about the Affordable Care Act? What are the other aspects of the health care law that you think will improve Americans' health care system that aren't really being discussed by the people or the politicians?
I think what we're missing, what really hasn't given the Affordable Care Act enough credit, is the cost containment reforms that it includes. It really was the most far-reaching effort so far to contain healthcare costs. It included an array of reforms to the way healthcare is paid for and delivered, and these reforms reward the value and the quality of care, not just the quantity of care. And I think it's worth taking a moment to go through some of them briefly. For example, starting in October, payments to hospitals with high rates of preventable readmissions and hospital-acquired infections will be reduced. Also, instead of paying a fee for each service, hospitals and doctors will receive a fixed amount for a bundle of services. This is called bundled payments, and this reduces incentives to increase the quantity of care. In addition, there's so-called value-based purchasing. That's when you link payments for hospitals and physicians to performance on quality measures. The Act creates a patient-centered outcomes research institute, which identifies what works best to improve the quality of care and healthcare outcomes. And finally, the last one I want to highlight is the Act creates an innovation center, which will develop and expand innovative payment models to improve the quality of care and reduce costs. So all these are examples of reforms to the payment and delivery system that will provide better care at lower costs, and the Affordable Care Act made a substantial down payment.
Well, Topher, maybe you could talk a little bit about the role of this entity called the Independent Payment Advisory Board that was also created under the Affordable Care Act. How is that playing a role in containing costs? Who did they replace? Who's on it? And why does it actually help make sense of pricing differences and costs in the healthcare market?
That's a great question. This is one of the key reforms to lower healthcare costs over the long term. And it's really to break the stalemate that exists in our political process where special interests lobby hard to prevent any reforms to increase efficiency of the healthcare system and to reform the payment and delivery system. So the board would reduce healthcare costs by implementing many of the reforms, the types of reforms that we just discussed. They're reforms that improve efficiency and cut waste. They are not reforms that will reduce benefits or ration care. In fact, the Affordable Care Act includes specific language to prohibit the board from rationing care, raising taxes or premiums, or increasing cost sharing or reducing benefits. So it's a key reform. It's one that is under attack, but hopefully it will stay in place.
Well, let's talk a little more about the cost containment value of the Independent Payment Advisory Board. But prior to this board, there was the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, which initiated a plan to seek lower bids in medical purchase. And I believe this resulted in a cost decreasing almost by 20%, saving Medicare millions of dollars. Tell us about what we learned from the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission about cost containment and how these are lessons being applied to the Independent Payment Advisory Board.
Well, this is a good example, a competitive bidding program. And let me step back and explain a little bit what that is. Instead of the government setting prices for products like wheelchairs, what Medicare would do is ask manufacturers and suppliers to compete to offer the lowest price to Medicare. So these are market-based prices, and oftentimes they're lower than what would have been set by the government. And this reform was experimented with in the early 2000s. It was found to reduce prices by 20% and save Medicare about $8.5 million without affecting quality or access. And based on the results of that experiment, the Independent Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, which advises Congress on Medicare, recommended expanding competitive bidding in 2003. It was a no-brainer. Congress did ultimately phase in an expansion of this program, but only 2 weeks after the program was first implemented in 2008, Congress terminated the contracts that existed and delayed the program. It wasn't until 2011 that the first round finally went into effect. and the benefits to seniors and taxpayers were substantial. The average price savings was 35% and is projected to save taxpayers $17 billion and beneficiaries $11 billion over 10 years. So this is an example of a reform that got delayed by special interests in Congress. It was a no-brainer. Ultimately, it will be expanded under the Affordable Care Act, but it took many years for that to happen. The Independent Payment Advisory Board, which we've been discussing, would have the authority to put this type of reform into place unless Congress can come up with a better reform that saves the same amount of money.
Topher, I think one of the things that's kind of driven the public crazy is one group says this will save America billions, and another group says this is going to cost America billions of dollars, right? But an area of cost containment that there hasn't been so much talk about is how do you contain costs through providing expanded coverage? Of course, we're going to take a good chunk of our 50 million uninsured Americans and provide them coverage by 2014 through the exchange and through expanded Medicaid and other mechanisms. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how expanded coverage and expanded access to care serves as a cost containment measure in some ways as well.
Well, of course, there's the point that we're trying to transform our healthcare system from a sick care system to a healthcare system where we provide access to preventive care that can save costs down the line, because emergency room care and institutional care at nursing homes, for example, is more expensive oftentimes. But the other point I want to make is that by having more people in the system, you broaden the health insurance pool, which means that you're bringing in healthy young people as well as sick and old people. You don't just have a system that's for one segment of the population. And by doing that, you lower premiums for everyone. This is where the controversial individual mandate comes into play. The whole purpose of that is to address the problem where people who don't have insurance show up at the emergency room and then expect their care to be paid for, and that care is not free. It's paid for by taxpayers. It's paid for by higher premiums for everyone else. So if instead we can encourage those people to get insurance up front and not just show up at the emergency room, that should lower premiums for everyone.
We're speaking today with Topher Spiro, Managing Director of Health Policy at the Center for American Progress, an independent, nonpartisan educational institute dedicated to improving the lives of Americans through progressive ideas and action. Mr. Spiro is focused specifically on promoting cost containment in healthcare through the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Topher, one area where there still seems to be quite a bit of uncertainty is health insurance exchanges. And these exchanges need to offer policies providing essential health benefits. I'm not sure if those are sort of minimum level benefits or not, but, you know, I think this is really generally good news for consumers trying to buy insurance on the open market. Tell us about these essential health benefits and why they are so important to the work of the insurance exchanges.
Well, the Affordable Care Act has a requirement that new health insurance plans in the markets that offer insurance to small businesses and to individuals directly, so not through your employer, that they cover essential health benefits, which is an extremely important consumer protection, and it's one that makes the exchanges and other health insurance market reforms work much more effectively. There are several purposes of essential health benefits. The first main one is to ensure that coverage provides access, of course, to essential health care. The law requires coverage of benefits within 10 broad categories, including maternity and newborn care, mental health benefits, prescription drugs. Many of these benefits are not typically covered by plans offered directly to individuals today. So these benefits will go a long way to ensure comprehensive coverage. The second purpose, I think, of this requirement is to say that insurers cannot design benefits to attract healthier individuals and deter sicker individuals. They can't, in other words, design plans that cherry pick only the people that they want to cover. And then the third major purpose of this requirement is to provide some standards to make it easier for consumers and small businesses to make apples-to-apples comparisons.
So, Topher, the health insurance exchanges were intended to be set up on a state-by-state basis, but of course we've heard a lot in the news about those states that, at least in this pre-election phase, have said that they're going to opt out. But they won't go without an exchange. They will, by default, have an exchange set up by the federal government. What are your thoughts on the implications for residents of those states that are not setting up their own exchanges in terms of benefits and policies available to them? Will it be one exchange for the rest of the country where the states haven't put one in place, or how's that going to play out?
Well, that's exactly right. So residents of Texas, for example, if Texas decides not to have an exchange, they don't need to fear that they won't be able to access the benefits of an exchange or the coverage that's made available through an exchange, because the federal government will work with the state of Texas, for example, to set up what's called a federally facilitated exchange. And what's important is that many of the insurance market reforms in the Affordable Care Act are minimum standards that apply across the country, regardless of whether a state decides to set up an exchange on its own. A good example is the requirement to cover essential health benefits that we discussed. Another example, of course, is the ban on discrimination based on health status. So insurance companies can no longer deny coverage for pre-existing conditions, for example. That protection will exist across the country in 2014, regardless of whether Texas or other states decide to set up their own exchange.
You know, we haven't really touched on the quality of care, which is one of the triple aims of the Affordable Care Act. And we recently had former Vermont Governor Howard Dean on the show saying he felt that the accountable care organizations supported by the health care law really had the power to improve quality of care by offering comprehensive patient-centered care. What aspects of the accountable care organization do you believe show the most promise in delivering cost containment and improving quality of care?
Well, let's step back and talk about what an accountable care organization is. It can mean many things, but basically it means a team of healthcare providers, including a hospital, physicians, nurses, that is accountable for all of a patient's care. And this encourages the team to coordinate care. And if they do a good job, they'll be able to keep a part of the savings that result from reducing costs from coordinating care. A good example in the private sector, actually, was established by Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts in 2009. They set up an accountable care organization that includes 1,600 primary care physicians and 3,200 specialists. It's been going on for 2 years now, and there are promising results already. It has been shown over 2 years to reduce healthcare costs by an average of almost 3%, which may not sound like a lot, but if you take 3% across national spending on healthcare, that's billions of dollars every year.
Topher, you have a number of such impressive advisors on your board, former CMS Administrator Dr. Don Berwick, Harvard economist David Cutler among them, and they all say pretty similar things. The health reform law, the Affordable Care Act, isn't perfect, but it's a solid foundation for moving forward. And as we have recently survived the Supreme Court hearing and anticipate it going forward and full implementation, what's part two? As you put on your futurist hat and you think, how these are the things that would need to be in the next set of legislative changes, what would you see those things being?
Well, I think it comes back to cost containment. The Affordable Care Act, really, you can think of that as the first generation of reforms to reduce healthcare costs. There needs to be a next generation. This is actually something that we've been thinking a lot about, David Cutler and Don Berwick, Zeke Emanuel, Peter Orszag, among others. And we're going to actually propose some bold reforms in the near future. I think this is the next step, is to really focus in on cost containment.
Tell us about any of the states that you've been working with that excite you in terms of, and we always sort of think about states as sort of the engine of innovation, and tell us what you're seeing out there in terms of states that excite you in terms of addressing cost containment, but also improving quality.
What really I think is important is innovations that focus on primary care, which you don't hear about as much. Focusing on primary care can achieve better outcomes at lower cost. The U.S. has a very high ratio of specialists to primary care physicians, and it ranks at the bottom in measures of primary care. So we need to look at health systems that have a higher percentage of primary care physicians, which results in more effective care, lower use of healthcare services, lower Medicare spending and higher quality. So I look for innovations called primary care medical homes, in which teams of primary care physicians, nurses, all work together to reduce costs and improve the quality of care. And the innovations that are most exciting to me are the ones that allow patients to engage with physicians more meaningfully. In this day and age, I can't understand why patients can't communicate with their doctors through email, for example. This kind of engagement and interaction is long overdue. We need to bring the practice of medicine into the 21st century. And there are examples across the country of both in the private sector and the public sector innovations that are implementing these types of reforms.
We've been speaking today with Topher Spiro, Managing Director for Health Policy at the Center for American Progress, an independent, nonpartisan educational institute dedicated to improving the lives of Americans through progressive ideas and action. Mr. Spiro, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, Mark and Margaret, this week let's talk again about Medicare. We've seen the Romney campaign continue to push the idea that cutting the growth in Medicare spending hurts Medicare's financing, but the opposite is true. Cutting spending, as the Affordable Care Act does, would help the program. Most of the cuts in the health care law come from reductions in the future growth of payments to hospitals, and that's Medicare Part A, which gets its income mostly from payroll taxes. If Medicare doesn't need to spend tax dollars right away, the money is credited to Part A's trust fund, and Medicare gets a treasury bond that it can cash in later anytime it needs the money. So by not spending as much as was otherwise expected, Medicare holds on to more of those trust fund bonds for longer, stretching out its Part A income. Now, the Romney camp also complains that the health care law counts those Medicare savings as money that can cover other aspects of the law. And it's true, the government accounting conventions show that happening. But that can't hurt Medicare's financing. Treasury has to pay the bonds it issues to Medicare, even if it had already spent the original tax money on something else. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. 1 in 5 American vets returning from the front lines of Iraq and Afghanistan have come home with a so-called invisible wound. An estimated 20% of returned vets are suffering from the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder and severe depression. The Veterans Administration has been seeking numerous avenues to improve the outcomes for these soldiers, many of whom are afraid to seek help due to stigma. Often, they don't seek help until the condition has caused other major difficulties in their lives. Addiction, failed relationships, inability to focus on jobs or schooling, even attempted or completed suicide. A pilot program launched at the VA Medical Center in San Francisco is showing some promising results in getting veterans screened and into needed treatment. A brief therapeutic intervention called motivational interviewing done over the phone is significantly more effective than a simple phone check-in, the more common practice. The study, published in a recent issue of General Hospital Psychiatry, shows that when motivational interviewing techniques are applied, veterans are far more likely to see the need for treatment. Clinicians gently interview vets over the phone, encouraging the participant to discern discrepancy between their core values and their actual behaviors. If they articulate the need to change certain behaviors, they are more likely to acknowledge a need to engage in treatment. In the study, the control group received just the call-ins, where the other group received 4 weekly motivational interviews over the phone. At the end of the study, 62% of those participants were still in treatment versus 26% of the control group, and most reported reduced substance abuse and less of a sense of stigma about their condition. Using simple, targeted telephone therapy sessions to facilitate treatment and recovery for tens of thousands of vets who are suffering, now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at wesufm.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.